Hello, and welcome to 6 Degrees from the City, a podcast about writing and Western Sydney. I'm your host, Fiona Wright, and I'm delighted to be talking in this, our second episode, to the novelist and newly turned playwright, Felicity Castagna. Felicity is the author of three novels, including Small Indiscretions, Stories of Travel in Asia, and The Incredible Here and Now, which won the Prime Minister's Award for Young Adult Fiction. Her new novel, No More Boats, was published in June this year. It follows a family living in Parramatta as they react to the Tampa crisis of 2001 and that high pitch of invasion anxiety and xenophobia that it engendered. Felicity lives in Parramatta, the rapidly changing capital city of Western Sydney, and I joined her in her home to the north of its CBD to talk about Australia's relationship with the boat, the demographic and geographic changes to Parramatta, and the challenges of adapting works for a different medium. Here's Felicity, reading from No More Boats.
It is 1967. The Australian Prime Minister, Mr. Harold Holt, swims out into the ocean and gets eaten by a shark. Or he gets picked up by a Chinese submarine and becomes a spy. It's possible that he just shouldn't be swimming, despite his reputation as a sportsman, because he's thrown his shoulder out of alignment and is taking morphine, and also because he might be depressed and maybe he doesn't want to live anymore. Others say he's murdered because he opposes building military bases at Pine Gap, or because he relaxed the White Australia policy so that the Asians can invade. It could also be because the oceans around Australia are rough places where boats are known to fall apart and people get caught in rips they can't see, and the people in the boats just disappear and no one knows why, or sometimes they do know, but no one wants to talk about what really happens out there, not really anyway. It is the day after Harold Holt has disappeared and Antonio Martone is standing in his new home. He is not yet the Antonio Martone who becomes so famous for a brief moment in history when his own existential crisis coincides with that of a nation that can't decide whether to let in a Norwegian shipping container named the MV Tampa and its cargo of 438 human beings who'd almost disappeared into the ocean like Harold Holt. For that brief moment between the unwanted ship sitting out there off the coast and the planes colliding into twin towers in another country, Antonio is everywhere holding that gun that may or may not have been his. He's staring blankly out of everyone's television sets and out of the copies of the Daily Telegraph you always find discarded next to you on the train seat. For now, though, he is just Antonio, and he's standing here thinking about how the future has finally picked its way out of his head and materialized in front of him. He lays his body down in the middle of the living room and thinks about what he has built. He always knew that the future was waiting for him in this new land across the sea. White aluminium siding, aluminium 8/8, yellow fiberboard shutters, high rectangular windows, crisp brown linoleum marking the path to the kitchen. Upstairs there are 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, total square footage, 1,265. He's done the front door in an arch. People don't always understand how much harder it is to bend wood and concrete into a half moon shape than it is to leave it in straight angular lines. But he knows it is a deep and private satisfaction to him every time he walks through his own front door. On the TV, talk of inundation and floods, rising tides, tsunamis of human beings coming across the ocean, all headed here, a watery invasion threatening to drag us under. Too many boats, same thing they've been anxious about since yesterday, the day before that, 200 years ago. And at this moment, 31st of August 2001, a day on which the Parramatta River was overflowing down near the ferry pier where this story begins and ends, there was flooding too. The footpaths around the river's edge were underwater. Disgruntled teenagers drank on the top of the grassy slopes because their usual spot on the benches below had become submerged. The old Chinese women with their mandarin playing boomboxes must have been doing their nightly riverside aerobics somewhere else. The Lebanese men had stopped fishing near the Housing Commission flats and got up and went to the fish markets instead. The tradies at the workers' club pressed cold beers to their mouths and smoked their ciggies on the balcony and made jokes about how the river could swallow their utes in the parking lot, while the public service servants from the newly relocated office of Sydney Water and Electricity stared out towards the river behind the polished windows of their bloated office blocks. Antonio's son Francis stood on the riverbank and looked out to the mangroves at the ferry that was making its way to the slim top of the pier that hadn't been swallowed by the water and said fuck into the evening air. He had just shoved his hands into his saggy jeans and discovered that he was out of cigarettes. 7:30 a.m. Friday, Claire walked because she liked to walk. It didn't matter that it took her an hour from Surrey Hills to Newtown. She liked looking. The women in tight skirts were barefoot on Devonshire and Belvoir, carrying their heels home from the nightclubs on Oxford Street. She walked under the overhangs of shops and looked through their windows at full-skirted 60s dresses, bright red plastic underwear, posters about the hazards of cigarette butts finding their way into drain pipes, people who spent hours in coffee shops reading newspapers and books. She was born to these city streets, even though she wasn't really born in the city. She was made to be born here, and when she walked through this street, she told herself that she was. Someone who was really born in the city, her mother. Claire knew exactly which terror she had lived in, but she couldn't ever picture her there. When her mother described the home she grew up in, it was all dull and grey and silent image, in which she was in a threadbare pinafore next to her stony, ruddy-faced English mother, no smiles to be seen. Now, someone had picked up the details of the window frame and guttering in a bright blue. On the bottom balcony, there were long rectangular pots of herbs, and on the top floor balcony, they had a wrought iron set of two red chairs and a table with a giant Buddha face hanging from the wall behind. Walking past there at night, Claire could often see the shadows of people behind the windows. Behind the front door grates, they had bicycles with baskets on the front, like the women from French movies rode to the markets. In Parramatta right now, her father would be sitting on a chair on his concrete front lawn, arms folded across his chest. Her mother would be sitting on a chair in the front lawn on their neighbour Lucy's perpetually half-built house, drinking tea and eating macaroons and joining in a running commentary on everyone that walked down the street. Her brother would still be out of it, getting over the night before. Here, walking down King Street, things were quiet. The only people out were small men with big dogs and women with dreadlocks and yoga mats. King Street, you could lose yourself here somewhere between a second-hand clothes shop and a Thai restaurant.
I really love the way you open with the great myth of Harold Holt, that there's so much that kind of circles back in the book about, you know, the kind of myths we tell about history and the myths we tell about nation. But they also play out so in such small ways in those characters' lives, mm-hmm. too.
I wanted to write a book in which, I guess, the history of Australia was tied to the history of a particular family. It's often described as like a book about refugees, which I don't really understand because I don't actually really think it is a book about refugees.
Yeah.
It is essentially a book about our relationship with the boat itself, and that has so many manifestations throughout Australian history, one of which is now quite obviously that of the refugee boat, which is on the news always and is so entrenched in all of our political elections and in our very image of not just refugees but of migrants in general, even though most refugees to Australia don't even come by boat.
Yeah.
But I wanted to take what I essentially see as our national icon, the boat, back in time and to trace our history of the fear of the boat and our fear of invasion right back to colonial Australia and
not the actual invasion.
Yeah, the actual invasion. Yeah, and I think, you know, a place like Parramatta is a perfect place to do that. Like, you know, we're sitting right near the mouth of the Parramatta River on which some of the first colonial settlers came to Australia and where Pemulwuy quite famously fought those settlers back in his own boats with the local indigenous.
The end point of the ferries too from the harbour, isn't it? They can't go any further.
Yeah, it is a place where the boats can go no further and that's written about a lot in early colonial diaries of this place, and I was always really interested in that image of the place where the boat can go no further. It seems to me it's such a metaphor for how the city has developed both from colonial times to the present. We have such a history of people coming here, you know, post-World War II by boat, not necessarily down the Parramatta River, but, you know, a lot of those people settled around here to work in the factories around Silverwater and Granville. And then later we've had a very large refugee population here, which is now, I think, been replaced by more upwardly mobile migrant population and migrants who first settle in other areas of the West.
And then sort of moved to Parramatta.
And then moved to Parramatta.
Yeah, right, that's interesting. Yeah.
I mean, as well as that, you know, back in the 1930s, there was a lot of British people who came out to Australia by boat and who established farms in this area. It was also a place even that British people kind of sent their young sons on holidays, people who had established homes in other parts of Sydney, because it was kind of like the Wild West and they wanted to have that experience. They sent their kids to like boys camps around this area where they would learn, you know, things like horseback riding and mustering and kind of how to be kind of real cliche Australian.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it has a very long and very interesting history with migration. I mean, even I would say what's kind of interesting about the migratory patterns here now is that a lot of people are migrating from the city.
Yes. you know. Yes, I was thinking of that, basically.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah, I think, yeah, there's the, I don't know, I have so many books about Parramatta in my head. And, you know, I think that the next ones I will write, I'm really interested in dealing with, I guess, the aspirational classes in this area. I'm currently writing a book that's set in a building that hasn't been built yet, but just a few blocks south from here, they're building the largest residential building in New South Wales, which will be called The Aspire.
I love that so much.
I know, it's like, if you're going to plunk a giant metaphor in the middle of my suburb, as if I'm not going to set a book there. So, so hopefully by that book will, you know, come out at the same time as the tower is open.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
I was wondering if it had been built yet, because as I was driving here, I could see some huge
Those are different huge towers. Yeah.
They don't aspire as highly.
They don't aspire as highly. Well, actually, the one that you probably saw is the altitude.
Beautiful.
It is. It's a beautiful building, actually. In my kind of research for my forthcoming novels, I've been pretending to buy real estate. And so I've grown up in that building.
I hadn't really thought about the poetry of property development.
It's like so many things. It's not just about Parramatta. It's about Parramatta as a kind of metaphor for the nation.
Yeah.
You know, like
that aspirational always gets thrown around as something that, well, that we should all aspire to be, funnily enough.
Yeah. Well, I kind of hate the way that aspirational, I don't know, people talk about the aspiring classes of the West, like particularly in terms of like those McMansion communities that are out here, because there's something, I don't know, it's associated with bad taste.
And consumerism.
Yeah. But I don't at all want to look at it that way because I feel like that's extremely patronizing.
Yeah.
And dishonors the fact that a lot of people work really hard to live in those houses that may be grotesque to somebody who lives in, like, you know, an old terrace in the city. But, you know, a lot of families don't want to live in an old terrace in the city.
It's one of the things I actually found most touching about No More Boats, that kind of honour that is given to the family at the heart of it and their friends too, that, like you say, they're from this class that's widely disparaged living in suburbia, which, you know, Australia has such a strange and ambivalent relationship with
suburbia,
And, you know, Antonio, his job is building McMansions.
Yeah.
But he's highly skilled at it.
Yeah.
And it gives his life a lot of meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. I think particularly migrant communities, invest a lot of meaning in their homes. You know, I was thinking of a lot about my own family who built their own houses. When I was writing this book, my dad is rebuilding at the moment his family home that they moved to when they first came to Australia. The whole extended family moved to this place called Ferradale, which is like in the middle of, it's still in the middle of nowhere. It's still actually not connected to the grid. Like it's,
is that Ferradale is in fairies and sprites? And
no, Ferradale. It's near Madawi Raymond Terrace, like outside of Castle.
Yeah.
They had a house there, but it literally got stolen because it's out in the middle of nowhere. no one lived there, my family, because they worked in the BHP, they kind of moved into town, and like, you know, nobody's wanted to live on this property for ages, and it's kind of unsaleable because no one wants to live somewhere where there's no water, electricity, phone reception, garbage removal, etc.
Someone does, but they've killed several people in the past.
Actually, that's his neighbors. There's literally seven families in Ferradale, and my family is one of them. Someone stole my basically parts of the house got stolen brick by brick because, you know, it was all like handmade bricks and stuff that my family had built, and tombstones, which is, you know, appears in the book. Yeah, they took a lot of old tombstones and built this house, which kind of made it, I guess, valuable from an antique kind of point of view. And so, yeah, people kind of stole the house brick by brick. And now he's rebuilt it as a giant American barn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the idea that if it were, you know, numerous people stealing individual bricks, that bits of that house could be
everywhere. Like, in sandstone's really expensive. And those kind of what we consider craft bricks. And, you know, they had old, you know, pot-bellied stoves and kind of old things.
Amazing.
That are, I guess, are valuable to
collect. When did your family come to Australia?
My dad's family came here in the mid-50s. Basically got on, they were from all over, but my grandmother was Greek, but she grew up in Egypt, and then when they kicked the Greeks out of Egypt, she moved to Ethiopia, as you do, where she met my grandfather, who was Italian, and, you know, there were a lot of Italians in Ethiopia at the time, and they got married there, and then there were multiple civil wars, and then lots of very complex conflicts. The British tried to kind of reclaim Ethiopia after it was taken back from the Italians. And so my family were put in internment camps there. And they escaped and went to Egypt. When I say my family, I actually mean my whole extended family. So, like, my grandmother, and, you know, there was several families that kind of moved. And my grandfather thought that English would be the next big language.
That was prescient.
Which is, they already, like, my dad's family, like, everybody speaks, like, six different languages. They thought English would be a good thing to learn next. So they got on the next boat to their first English-speaking country, and it was Australia. And so that's how they came here.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's such a, obviously it's a really complex
It's very hard to, summarize the palatial and political histories of my family. It's kind of like it would be a book in itself. Something that I don't even understand all the intricacies of it. Yeah.
But I think, like, that, again, it's the same sort of thing, that interest in intricacy, I think, really comes through in the histories of, you know, of Antonio and his family, the different kinds of migrants that they are, and the very different opinions on migration that they then have. I felt like that was a really important thing to do in the book. You know, I tell this story a lot, but my mother worked as a TAFE teacher for a long time, teaching adult basic education in Bankstown. So she had a lot of you know, most of her students were migrants who had poor English, and she was sort of helping out. She was teaching them. I remember her telling us about the very different political opinions that they held about issues that up until that point I'd kind of assumed would be a kind of blanket thing, like, of course they're all going to support migration because they're migrants. And yeah. I think you kind of tease that apart really beautifully in the book. It's humanising.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point of fiction is not to judge, but to present complex lives. Like, it would be very easy, given that Antonio does some fairly horrible things, to set him up and to judge him. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to show that he had his own traumas and stuff. That doesn't excuse the fact that he treats some of the migrants in his community poorly. But it makes him a complex figure, and that's what makes him human. And, you know, I think so much of the work about migrants that I have read in Australian literature is all about this kind of migrant journey. So migrants come to Australia and they're all kind of like weird, you know, like wogs out of work, or like looking for Alibrandi or something like that. And then, you know, gradually people accept them and find out that they're not so weird. And it's not that there's not a place for that kind of a story, but I guess growing up in a family in a very, I would call my family transnational as opposed to kind of migrant, because, I mean, we ourselves also migrated, just like my father's family. We are Australian.
Continued to move, didn't you?
And continued to move around a lot. But that, I guess, is reinforced in me that the migrant's position is a lot more complex than a lot of the things I see in Australian literature. And I wanted to write characters that were that complex,
And that have different ways of belonging and different ways of moving through the city too. And I think that extract that you read with Claire is a really lovely kind of demonstration of that.
I think as well as, I don't know, like, they have different traumas, and there's always things that surprise you. Like even, I mean, it was really interesting. I didn't actually, before I wrote this book, I didn't actually realise that some of my family members were in Villawood. And in other quite famous, like, similar migrant hostels around Australia, because my immediate family wasn't. So, like, my grandparents and my father weren't. But I was discussing the book with my great uncle, and it turns out that basically all my other, like, my grandmother's had a lot of brothers that came here, and they were all in those detention centres. And I was talking to my Uncle Luigi about this, and my Uncle Luigi, he's kind of like, I don't know, he's almost a stereotype of a kindly old Italian man, you know, like with the woolen socks, and the suspenders, and, you know, like, his hobby is going to church. He goes to, like, four different churches because, you know, one kind of satisfies me. And, you know, he, like, does Meals on Wheels 7 days a week, you know, like beautiful, like, never raises his voice or speaks unkindly of anybody. And, like, it was like we were talking about these you know, migrant hostels that a lot of post-World War II migrants moved to, that I did a lot of reading and research about for my book, but never thought to actually ask my family about. And it was like suddenly his face turned quite, you know, hard, and he was like, oh, it was horrible. They were horrible. Like, those people were horrible to us, and we didn't have enough food, and there wasn't enough shelter, and people were horrible to us all the time. And I've never actually literally seen him speak badly about anybody. Yeah. And it was like he really wanted me to know that, like, people were really horrible. And it just reminded me that there's all these kind of, like, you know, there are all these kind of traumas that pop out in interesting places and in interesting ways.
I was going to ask you about Villawood, actually, because it is a strong presence in the book. It's where Rose and Antonio
met. So the main, it's about, the book centres around a family, and the father, Antonio, in the book, was housed in Villawood when he first came here, and his wife was a cook there, and that's how they met and got married. Mm-hmm. And they both kind of exoticized each other, which, you know,
which is lovely.
Yeah,
in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, it comes back up with when Antonio's thinking about Tampa and the boats that are coming. Mm-hmm. That Villawood has changed.
Yeah,
but also not changed.
Yeah.
In the intervening time.
Yeah. Mm. I liked being one of the great things about telling a book that's from four different perspectives. So it's from Rose, his wife, Antonio, and their adult children's perspectives, is that you can take the same place and show how it's seen in so many different ways. So for Rose, it was, you know, an escape from the city. She, you know, really exoticized the migrant population there. You know, she thought her husband was incredibly handsome, you know, with his olive skin, and she was in this kind of, for her, it was like going to Europe, you know, you know, after living in, you know, kind of working class Surrey Hills. And for him, it was a space, the first lens through which he began to see Australia. And now, of course, we associate Villawood with refugee detention, which also comes up in the book. And there's a whole debate between the characters in the book about whether or not it was a horrible place both then and now.
Yeah.
And to different characters, it's seen both as a place of liberation and as a place of
huge suffering,
humiliation, and yeah. huge suffering. And of course, you know, Rose can't get her head around the images she sees on TV of, you know, people of their refugees that live there sewing their lips together you know, throwing themselves on the razor wire outside because it means something different to her.
Yeah.
And that, again, is really interesting to me to show a place and to show how it can be seen, how places contains so many layers and layers and layers and layers of stories. When you scratch the surface, you get a few of them, and how does that reverberate throughout time?
And this is what you mean when you talk about place-driven narrative, isn't it? This,
yeah.
Am I assuming that right?
Yeah. I've always, you know, again, like I always say this, you know, in writing we teach students that writing fiction is either character or plot-based, but I always think that writing can be place-based and can be driven by place. And for me, that's how I write from place, and it's the place itself that drives who the characters become and how the narrative shapes itself.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting and so pertinent, and it makes me wonder why more people don't talk about that.
Well, place is so interesting. I mean, places are so many different characters in themselves. I mean, particularly when you talk about Western Sydney.
Mm.
And, you know, I think, even like I hate kind of that term Western Sydney. If there was one thing I could take out of any of my books, it would be in my second book, In the Incredible Here and Now, it begins with a passage about Western Sydney. And I would remove that because I kind of hate talking about that Western Sydney because, I mean, you know, Liverpool is an entirely different place than Parramatta. And, you know, Macquarie Fields is an entirely different place than Penrith, you know. You know, I'm writing about Parramatta. I'm not really writing about Western Sydney.
Yeah.
It's part of Western Sydney. It's the capital of Western Sydney, but it's got its own character.
But I think that sort of speaks to the time in which that book was written too, right? That
true, yeah.
That was very much when, and I mean, we were both a part of this, part of that kind of attempt to start writing the West in a way that hadn't really been done before. And I think that just speaks to the fact that the literature is developing and that this understanding of the West not being this monolith is really beginning to permeate.
Yeah, I think that that's the new I think we were all writing about, you know, the West, and now I think people are starting to consider more very specific places and specific aspects of those places. Like, I think now what I'm most interested in is writing Parramatta in the flux of massive change.
Yes.
And that wouldn't be as relevant to, you know, I mean, I'm around wider Western Sydney all the time, but those kind of massive in their own world. So, you know, there's a very different character to everything in Western suburbia.
Yeah.
And I feel like I can really only capture the character of this place.
I'm interested in the big changes happening here at the moment that you just alluded to, that yeah. I know the big project is called Building Australia's Next Great City.
Yeah.
I have a student who's obsessed with that phrase and keeps writing about it, which I find fantastic.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I wish they were my student. that's Parramatta Council's tagline. And even on their logo now, it's two big cranes. And it is, like, I feel disoriented in this place all the time, even though literally I live here, I work here, my kids go to school here. Like, I pretty much only socialize here. So I spend my whole life, like, just walking up and down Church Street. And every, even, like, from one week to the next, I'm like, what is this place? it's insane. And, you know, I mean, it's filled with, like, you know, it's starting to be filled with trendy bars and these incredible high-rise building. I remember there was this one moment, like, 5 years ago, I went to Coles. So I went to Coles. This happened, like, 5 years ago. There's this Coles that I go to all the time. There's a couple of blocks from here. And I went there about 5:30, and I guess there was a lot of kind of office workers there and probably local people as well. And I remember just looking at the fruit and looking up, and it was like all of a sudden there were all these, like, hipsters, and I was like, fuck, it's like Newtown. and I was like, what the fuck happened to this place? And it was like this incredible realization.
You know, I had a moment like that just this week when I was visiting my family to go see my sister and her new baby. And my family had been talking about this new cafe that had opened called the Bakehouse. So I was like, oh, well, it's got to be better than the Michelle's Patisserie that I used to work in.
Yeah, yeah.
And walked in there and had some big signs up saying, you know, we serve little marionette coffee, which, of course, is brewed in Annandale, not, you know, 15 minutes from where I live now. And I freaked out. But it was amazing and I was so excited. I think it's, like, part of Sydney changing so much.
It is
too, but it just seems
it's really important amongst that to remember that what is also happening in this community is that those families that once struggled before are struggling more.
Yes.
And that they're still here. And so, you know, I mean, I talk about it in terms of this apartment building.
Yeah.
When we moved here, like, 16 years ago, it was all of the apartments in this block, you know, they're still mostly migrant families, but, like, it was in each apartment you had maybe a couple. Sometimes you had a couple with a younger kid.
Yeah.
There is nobody that lives in this building now that has less than about four people in every apartment. We have four people in this apartment. Upstairs, they have about eight people in their apartment. Downstairs, they've got about six, you know. Next door, you've got, you know, the grandparents plus the parents plus the two kids plus aunts and uncles that sometimes come and stay there. You've also got, you know, like, I work a lot in the local schools and high schools, and you do have these kind of older families who have lived here and have always lived here and who are still living here but struggle incredibly in this space. Yeah. And, you know, it's good to remind ourselves that, like, when there's, you know, there's massive arts festivals here and, you know, you go to things like Tropfest and the National Theatre of Parramatta and, you know, we have Art Month and all these amazing things here. But there's, you know, large sections of this population who don't access that at all in any way. So what you have now is this community where you have people that are more different than have ever been. Like, we've always talked about this community. Like, one of the things I've always liked about Parramatta is, even though it is a migrant community, it's not a community where one nationality or ethnicity necessarily dominates. Yeah. It's always been culturally diverse. But now you have these incredible extremes of wealth and poverty here, which kind of go beyond ethnicity and nationhood. Like, you have them in all the ethnicities that are around here. And also this incredible divide between the older families and the newer families. So, you know, newer families coming here who have much more money.
Yeah.
And that's actually not even to disparage them. I just think, you know, places change.
Yeah.
But it does create this community that with incredibly, incredibly different people living here. I mean, we're now a liberal stronghold.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, it is, you know, and but most of those people who are voting liberal are like new migrant populations here.
Mm.
Because again of that aspirational aspect, and they feel that the Liberal Party will get them further than people like the Greens, who, you know, also campaign avidly around here, but who I think often make the assumption that people with less money will like their ideals more,
yeah, yeah,
which is absolutely not true. So, yeah, I mean, there's very interesting divisions
and here now, yeah,
that are growing and becoming more extreme all the time. You know, all the stuff that we now have access to is not stuff that everybody is accessing.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And this is the stuff that the questions, I guess, that are feeding into that new novel, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'd like to deal with those questions of, like, how do we all now live side by side? I think we've talked about that issue of how do many different migrant populations sit side by side, but how do many migrant populations sit side by side also with many different classes and many different world views? I think Parramatta is probably more socioeconomically and politically diverse than most other areas of Sydney.
Yeah.
Because if you look at like gentrification that's happened in other areas, it's been much more long term than here. The gentrification,
yes,
really here. I would even argue it's really only 5 or 6 years old. Some people might argue it's maybe a decade old, but I would, like, if you look at rentals and property prices in this area, they weren't actually affordable 5 or 6 years ago. Mm. They're not now.
And it's a different sort of gentrification too. I think, you know, I live in the inner west now. Mm. And the sort of gentrification that happens there is a whitewashing in a way too. They,
yes,
talk about Ashfield in particular, for,
yes,
example, as being the only suburb in Sydney that's becoming less culturally diverse with every passing year.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's different here.
I actually wouldn't argue at all that there is a whitewashing in Parramatta. And actually, if you look at the last census, the migrant population and the amount of languages spoken here have actually grown exponentially. But a lot of the – you used to get a lot of new migrants here.
Yeah.
You now get a lot of migrants who go to more outlying parts of the west and establish themselves, and then they move into Parramatta.
Yeah.
And the migrants that tend to be moving here across all different, whether or not you're talking about Indians or Africans or Asians, or they tend now to be people who are more educated, who are working in more stable jobs, who are more aspirational.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. It's,
yeah,
a fascinating part of the city.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Well, it's, you know, it's a fascinating part of Australia, I think, you know. It's the third largest city in Australia, you know, which is, I still think of it as a suburb because, you know, it used to be.
it's so interesting
to
me.
But it's not really.
It's so interesting to me that part of this Next Great City campaign is sort of this shrugging off.
Of its suburbanness.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
And yet it is, I don't know, it's strange because it still does have that suburban mentality here. Like, you know, you can kind of go around those big buildings and those fancy new restaurants,
yeah,
and think you're in a city. But then you come, you know, like right now we're in North Parramatta, I can walk to the CBD in, you know, 15 minutes tops. But it's really suburban,
yeah,
here,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of families. There's still some remaining homes in the streets behind us.
There's a huge park across the road, which I noticed was called Richie Bennett Park, which just delighted me.
There's a new park named after Kevin Rudd, who was the local member here for many years. Actually, he was the local member during the Tampa crisis.
Yeah.
So, you know, like...
called Kevin Rudd Park, or,
yeah,
just Rudd Park?
No, there's a few places around here called Kevin Rudd, etc. You know, I think they're thinking about naming a new pool after him too.
Which I guess is better than the Tony Abbott pool. That would be
in Manly.
That would be something horrific.
Yeah.
I did want to ask you about the idea of a historical novel. I think kind of using Kevin Rudd as a segue there.
Mm.
One of the things that I was interested in is that, you know, the book set in 2001, and that is historical in a sense, even though it's still recent history.
Yeah.
And I wondered if that was something that you...
It was funny because I wanted to pick a major incident in our history that had to do with boats.
Mm.
And so that seemed appropriate to me. And yet as I was writing it, you know, there's always another major incident having to do with boats.
Yes.
And I always, like, I would go into this panic because I'm like, oh, I need to reset it in a more contemporary time. I think in the end what I decided was that there's always going to be a new incident with boats. And it kind of, to me, the Tampa transcends history. It is a historical moment, but at the same time, you know, it was the beginning of our Turn Back the Boats policy. It was, I mean, we now forget that elections before 2001 didn't contain any kind of discussion really about refugees or boats, whereas now boats and migration itself are in all of our discussions. So
part of it's that lovely line you had in that first section that you read about the brief moment between Tampa and September 11.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I also wanted to deal with the pre-September 11 world and the fact that we were afraid of migration a lot before then.
Yeah.
I think if I set the book in a more contemporary time, I would have associated the boat with Islam more,
because
I think it is associated more with, I think a lot of our fears now are about Muslim migration. That's less an aspect of the book because of the time that it's set in.
Yeah.
But I do feel like Tampa kind of, it is something that transcends history because we have Tampa, we have a new Tampa every week.
And often the media isn't allowed to report on them anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And even I also wanted to be able to talk about that time where we were talking about establishing offshore detention, like in Manus and Nauru, and it seemed so crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like looking at pictures of, you know, islands like Nauru, which it had like its core scooped out of it from mining, and the idea that we were going to send people to a place with no sanitation and water and a place which struggled to care for its own people. I remember thinking that seemed so nuts and like, of course it wasn't going to happen. And so to bring us back, I also wanted to bring us back to a time, and, you know, the characters talk about seeing those images of those islands on TV and, you know, the idea of the Pacific solution. And it was crazy at one point.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. And even, you know, the idea of associating boat people with Muslim terrorists was crazy, you know, at that time. And I wanted to remind us of that as well.
It's funny, sort of speaking of the craziness, the thing I remember most about it was how angry I was.
Mm.
And, you know, maybe it's just attrition, but, you know, I'm still angry, don't get me wrong, but I was, you know, I was livid, I was furious, and itching out of my skin. And all the more so because I remember that the election where Howard was re-elected, that election was held on the day before my 18th birthday.
So it overshadowed a major birthday, horrible.
it was like the day before and I was like, God damn it. And there is nothing I can do.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Well, even at the time, it seemed crazy that Howard would get in.
Yeah.
Until he had, you know, the great scapegoat, which was the Tampa.
Mm.
So I wanted to take us back. And even when you mentioned that anger, you know, there were mass protests at the time, and we haven't seen. We've certainly had protests about our refugee policies, but we haven't had the mass ones that happened around the time of the Tampa. And I really wanted that to be the kind of end point of our book, of the book as well. And I wanted to really talk about the Pauline Hanson era. I mean, I know we're still in the Pauline Hanson yes. era. But again, now it seems kind of normalized, whereas back then...
it was shocking.
It was shocking. And it's not even really that shocking anymore that she gets such a large percentage of the vote. I mean, even, you know, since we just voted in our local council elections, you know, Australia First and, you know, a couple of other much more right-wing extremist parties were, you know, they were standing out in front of my local primary school. And One Nation wasn't actually on the ballot, but more extremist parties were.
Yeah, yeah.
So ones that are whose policies are actually far more extreme than One Nation. And, you know, I wanted to ask
you about the extremists in the book too, because there's a group that kind of take Antonio under their wing.
Yeah.
I mean, even they're human. It's
Well, it's interesting that, I did a lot of research into right-wing extremist parties. I mean, people think of the Western suburbs as the bastion of multiculturalism, and that's true, but it's also the home of right-wing extremism and white nationalism, where most of these parties are based. But interestingly enough, a lot of those parties are actually headed by migrants.
Yes.
And some of them even by people who are from refugee families. And I had to change some names and things in the book, so I'm not even going to, like, mention the names of particular politicians and parties in case. I don't know, I get a bit squeamish about it. But, you know, that the right-wing politicians in the book are based on two local right-wing politicians who are head of very popular parties. One is a Sri Lankan refugee and one is a Syrian, from a Syrian refugee family, but he claims to be Greek. Those are real people who are actually heading right-wing parties out here. And so I think rather, you know, it's no good to have this debate where we just say these guys are fucked and ignore them and not engage with their humanity as well. And I'm saying that as somebody who has always been on the very left of the political spectrum and who does not support their policies. But I think if you're really going to talk about racism and you're really going to talk about marginalization and you're really going to talk about why right-wing extremism is growing in Australia and in the Western suburbs, then you do need to engage with people's humanity and you do need to engage with the fact that these people are coming from lots of places. That is not to excuse the fact that most of their parties, most of the constituents who are being led by them are actually white people. And it's not to take the blame away from white people, but to say that there are a lot of... John Safran wrote about this in his latest book, Depends What You Mean by Extremism, which I've been enjoying because we researched a lot of the same people.
Yeah, right.
So that's been really interesting. But again, like, these people are really, really complex.
Yeah.
And even like, we, particularly the left, you know, writes them off as ignorant, but a lot of the like leaders of a lot of the right-wing parties, the people with PhDs, you know, are lawyers and engineers, and these are not dumb people, and they're not people who don't understand migration or haven't met migrants. And if we really want to understand what they're doing and we want to stop what they're doing, then we actually need to meet them as human beings and see them as human beings and discuss them. It's really easy to write people off as evil and you don't move forward that way, you know?
Yeah. But they have an interesting relationship with Antonio.
Yeah, too.
They kind of
use him.
Yeah. And he's so ambivalent the whole way about it too. He's never quite sure.
No, he's not.
What's going on or how he feels about it.
I kind of felt that way when I was reading about a lot of people who were involved in right wing, like I follow a lot of their blogs and stuff. And I felt that they also weren't quite sure. They were also looking for answers and for discussions. Antonio is based on another Italian who was taken into a right-wing party and became a kind of poster boy. Well, he's a migrant and he agrees with us, and who I think was used. And I do actually think a lot of post-World War II migrants are used in this debate. And... yeah, I guess, yeah, I wanted to talk about everyone's complexity and everyone's humanity. Luke come and so he read my book. He's like, you know what really annoys me about your writing? He's like, I'm just annoyed with your characters because, you know, you're so unrelentingly positive towards everyone. And I was like, I'm not positive. Like, the whole point is that I'm not neither positive or negative. Yeah. I'm merely trying to present a picture of human beings that you can read and judge for yourself and take what you want from. It's easy to set up a character and judge them and
yes, them as absolutely.
Like, it's easy. Like, that's what really emerging writers do, and I would hope that by now, like, I'm a bit more established in my craft.
I was just thinking, because I see you've got Elizabeth Allen's book here on your desk.
Yeah.
That she has a poem about... a woman that she sees walking down King Street in Newtown, you know, wearing a skirt from Made 590 on King Street and, and shoes from this expensive shop on King Street. And, she's sort of dressed in the full Newtown costume. And the last line is something like, you know, it's very simple to make
judgment.
I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it's simple to write this poem, but much harder to take her seriously.
That's it. It's really hard to take people seriously and have a discussion with them. And I feel like I have discussions with people all the time, not just in real life, but like through literature. And that's what readers should be doing as well, engaging in discussion through reading.
I think that's one of the pleasures of reading, right? That for me at least, one of the reasons I love to read is that you are presented different ways of living.
Exactly.
And different ways of being in the world. You know, if that makes you reconsider your own or even just broaden your ideas about your own, then what a remarkable thing to be able to do.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. It is about reading and writing as a discussion, which, you know, makes us more humane. So it's about, I guess, you know, painting characters with humanity, and the reading of those characters is something that makes us more humane and more in dialogue with the world.
Can we talk for a little bit about Claire and Rose?
Yeah, sure.
And, oh gosh, I've forgotten her name. Rose's neighbour friend.
Lucy.
Lucy. I wanted to talk about them because I was so excited about them. One of the things that I really love about your writing, Referral Luke Cum would say, that really annoys me about your writing because you're too good at it, has always been how, you know, you write such strong, such interesting male characters and have a real kind of eerie ventriloquism with young men in particular, which, you know, I think we've spoken about coming from a high school teaching boys for so many years that you learn how they learn how they speak probably in the most terrifying way possible. This is a very backhanded compliment. But I was so excited to see more women in your work. Was that sort of challenging, or is it a challenge that you set for yourself? Or
yeah, I mean, at the moment, I'm just before I get to that, like, I'm actually writing a book that has no men, that has just all women, and I find that incredibly hard. I think in some ways it's easier to write something that you were slightly outside of because you can look back at it, whereas I think, you know, I am a woman. And to articulate kind of what that means is a lot harder. And to be honest, I don't think that the women in No More Boats are as well drawn as the men in No More Boats. I think I've done a better job with the men, and that makes me feel bad. I don't know.
I just really love Claire. There was was a lot that I loved about her. You know, I thought her experiences as a teacher were so interesting, and her pattern of movement. You know, and her way of thinking about the division or the relationship between the city and the suburb. And obviously, as someone who moved in the same direction from the suburb towards the city, and kind of walks around like that, you know, resonated with me. And I think there is a sort of strange patterning that happens when you can be in that space and remembering. And I think the very first poem I wrote about the West was kind of about how weird it was to move away from that space and to see all these things that were completely normal to people who lived in that space all the time but were fascinating to me.
Yeah. I like that idea that Claire goes to the city and sees the city as something that is different, because the city itself in Australian literature is so naturalized, as opposed to the suburb. So I like that she sees the weirdness of the city and that she fits awkwardly with it. I like that she kind of sees her. I also like, you know, she's one of these women, I guess, that sees herself as on the left of the spectrum and as very intelligent and educated, but ultimately is far less humane, I think, than, say, her less educated, more working class brother. And that's another kind of side of humanity I wanted to write about as well. So I might also have these kind of right-wing figures who are humanized, but I, in some ways, have dehumanized the left-wing figures as well.
Or I think of it more as, like, denaturalizing the people that
are meant to be heroes.
De-othering the people who are meant to be othered.
You're so much better at knowing what I did than me. Yes, that's exactly what I did. cool, yeah, I'm gonna take that and say that on some writers with civil panels.
So who are these women in the new work?
In the new work,
who are
these women? so there's I'm returning to young adult work. Actually, I'm individually writing a young adult novel, and I'm co-writing another young adult novel, both of which are all women. So in the individual work, I have two young girls from this area who steal a car from a boy, and go joyriding all the way to the Snowy Mountains and back. But on the way, they hit a local homeless woman who they pick up, and she kind of insists on going on their journey with them. A lot of it is about different women from different generations speaking about the different generational aspects of what it means to be a woman, and women talking across class. And something similar is happening in the book that I'm co-writing. I'm co-writing a book with Sheila Pham and another great writer called Faith Chazza. We have all adopted young women who are from our own kind of cultural and class backgrounds, and are writing a novel in three different perspectives in which we get to talk across our own kind of cultural and class backgrounds. So for me as well, that kind of links into the changing nature of the space. Like, how do you talk across all of these different people in this community and their understanding of this place?
And be really cross-cultural in a way.
And being really cross-cultural. Like, how do you write a really cross-cultural novel where you write with other cultures?
Yeah. Are you collaborating more, do you think? I'm interested in collaboration.
I'm doing a lot of collaboration at the moment, which is new to me. And something I'm working my way through, and I make lots of mistakes, and we try things again, and so I'm collaborating on that writing on that novel. I'm also collaborating at the moment on some installation art projects with a local multimedia artist called Marion Abood, in which we are collecting women's stories and turning them into sound and multimedia installations. One's forthcoming in Parramatta Lanes, and we'll also be putting some in other spaces, in other festivals around Western Sydney. I just finished adopting my second novel into a play, which is a massive collaboration. So collaborative, I didn't even understand how collaborative a play was until I was asked to write one. Which was, an incredible culture shock in a way. Because I'm not used to,
Well, theatre and literature are really different worlds.
Oh, yeah.
My first job was in theatre, and I didn't realise how different it was until I rocked up there, and I knew nothing. And I was like, how can I know nothing?
I knew nothing. Yeah.
The other thing that sort of shocked me there was sort of there are strong characters in the literature community as well, but we're like strong, gross generalizations here. But I tend to think like the weirdness of writers is that we all want to be alone by ourselves and kind of socially awkward.
Yeah.
And the strong characters in theatre are just massively extroverted. I just want to be in your face all the time.
Yeah, that was such a shock. It was really quite shocking, like, to sit, you do all of these kind of readings with actors and all of a sudden they start saying things to you like, my character wouldn't say that, and you're like, I am your character. Your character is in my head. And they argue with you, and then, the director argues with you, and then, like, the set designer and the and the person who does the sound is like, you can't do that. That's for a film. We're doing a play. And I'm like, what's the difference? But it's actually amazing. Like, it was, one of the directors of the National Theatre of Parramatta kind of, said, let's go on a walk after the first couple of weeks of rehearsals. And she wanted to just have a coffee and have a chat, and she started saying, a lot of people are kind of a lot of writers are really destroyed once they get into the rehearsal. Are you okay? And I was like, oh yeah, I'm okay. and I can see why a lot of writers are destroyed. It's an incredibly confronting experience, but one that I'm incredibly grateful for, and one that I think has really made it a much better work. And I kind of feel like, I don't know, in some ways I feel like actors and set designers and all these people get really ripped off in plays, because I didn't realise just how much they co-author everything.
Yeah.
Like, you're not the author anymore. I mean, even, one of the characters, ad-libbed his lines in a completely different way, like, every single night.
Wow.
It was completely different. Like, he was kind of riffing off the lines that I wrote, but, he brought it into his own, and it was, it was great. And new lines would appear all the time when I would show up at rehearsals, and I'd be like,
okay. That wasn't in the book.
that wasn't in my script. But even the way that people hold themselves is is a rewriting of the text. Like, I didn't imagine that the characters would actually even though I wrote the lines, and even when they were saying the exact lines, I didn't imagine that it would be said with that kind of a personality or that kind of a tone, which completely rewrote the lines, essentially.
I wonder if one of the things I love about theatre is that it's so bodied. The work that we do isn't, in a way. And sometimes that's experiences like, being in a theatre and people having certain gaits, or I've got a really strong memory of a performance that I went to once where, suddenly on stage everybody got naked for whatever reason, and I was like blown away by how powerful that was, because there were bodies there in front of you. And and it's like that's an extra tool that they have to play with that we don't.
Yeah, and they're incredible. Like, you know, I mean, as confronting as it was at first to have somebody tell you that they knew your character better than you, they were right. You know, like they spent all of this time thinking, like even they would ask me about the backstories of the characters, and I'd be like, I don't know if that wasn't in the book. where they grew up or whatever, or like I don't know what their early childhood was like. What are you talking about? But like they would invent these incredible backstories for the characters and like bring them to life in different ways. And you know, I found it amazing watching the character of Dom die on stage.
Yeah.
Like so, for me as a writer, I was like, you know, I can do that on a book, in a book, but. You know, in quite subtle ways.
Yeah.
Well,
it's actually one of the things that I love about The Incredible Here and Now, that, like, Dom is kind of an absence in the book in so many ways. Like, he's there, but there's a hole around him. And to me that felt like a really honest portrayal of grief, that it's not something that you touch directly. You sort of
walk around it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, in the play it's interesting. He appeared as a ghost, and basically he didn't disappear. So in the book he disappears and everyone talks about him. But in the play, you know, we worked out that he actually needed to be on stage and sometimes even talk, because on stage, unlike a book, silence kind of, you can't show the absence of space. The only way that you can show the absence of something is actually by making it present and filling up the space. So I had to show his absence from their life by making him permanently present on stage as a ghost. That's how he manifests. That's how we knew that he was always in their thoughts. Whereas like on a page I can write that they're having these internal reflections. You can't have them speak what they're thinking internally all the time. Otherwise it's just like these weird interior monologues that, you know, are strung together on stage. So, yeah, you needed to be present. So it was really interesting for me to watch it transform from a book to a stage play, and to realise what was needed, you know, through a lot of mentorship. And, you know, I'm very grateful for the National Theatre of Parramatta for giving me that mentorship and giving me that opportunity.
Well, I think presences and absences is a nice place to...
To finish up.
Thanks so much for chatting to me, Felicity, and for having me in your house.
Degrees from the City is supported by the Crown Packer Foundation, the Sydney Review of Books, and the Writing and Society Research Centre at Western Sydney University. Our theme music is by Phil Fadul, and production assistance is from Ben Denham. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again soon.